this is Rogue Finch Radio. The segment you're about to hear was part two in a two-part series, Ashanti and the Black Revolutionary Movement. It originally aired on March 7th, 1999.
Got lost through the satellite, got lost in the ride up to the plunge down. Man sends the ray of the electric light, sends the impulse through the air down to home. And you can stand on the arms of the Williamsburg Bridge crying, hey man, well this is Babylon. I've seen you fire up the gas in the engine valves. I've seen your hand turn saintly on the radio dial. I've seen the airwaves pull your eyes towards heaven. Outside Topeka in the phone lines, her good teeth smile was winding down. Engine sputters, ghosts out of gasoline fumes. They say you had it, but you sold it. You didn't want to know. I'm half drunk on babble. You transmit through your true dreams. True dreams.
Hi, this is Rogue Finch Radio. I'm your host, Patty Heffley, coming to you from the studios of Au Chateau Patrice in New York City. Rogue Finch Radio is a work in progress with lots and lots of variety. We will be here in one mutation or another, sometimes bringing you our own productions and other times productions by our friends from around the planet. You never know. Hello, everyone. This is part two in a two-part series about the Black Revolutionary Movement, as told by my guest Ashanti Alston, former member of the Black Panther Party and a Black Liberation Army prisoner of war. But first, here is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
George Jackson was my hero. He set a standard for prisoners, political prisoners, for people. He showed the love, the strength, the revolutionary fervor that's characteristic of any soldier for the people. He inspired prisoners, whom I later encountered, to put his ideas into practice, and so his spirit became a living thing. A quotation from Dr. Huey P. Newton, Ph.D., former Minister of Defense of the Black Panther Party at the Revolutionary Memorial Service for George Jackson in 1971. August, in both historic and contemporary African-American history, is a month of meaning. It is a month of repression. August 1619, the first group of black laborers called indentured servants landed at Jamestown, Virginia. August 25th, 1967. Classified FBI memos went out to all bureaus nationwide with plans to, quote, disrupt, misdirect, discredit, or otherwise neutralize, unquote, black liberation movement groups. August 1968. The Newark, New Jersey Black Panther Party office was firebombed. August 25th, 1968. L.A. Black Panther Party member Steve Bartholomew, Robert Lawrence, and Tommy Lewis were murdered by the LAPD at a gas station. August 15, 1969, Sylvester Bell, San Diego Black Panther Party member, murdered by the US organization. August 21, 1971, Black Panther Party Field Marshal George L. Jackson, assassinated at San Quentin Prison, California. Three guards and two inmate turncoats were killed, three wounded. It is also a month of radical resistance. August 22, 1831, Nat Turner's Rebellion rocks Southampton County, Virginia, and the entire South when slaves rose up and slew their white masters. August 30th, 1856, John Brown led an anti-slavery raid on a group of Missourians at Osawatomie, Kansas. August 7th, 1970, Jonathan Jackson, younger brother of Field Marshal George, raided the Marin County Courthouse in California, arming and freeing three black prisoners, taking the judge, prosecutor, and several jurors hostage. All except one prisoner were killed by police fire that perforated the escape vehicle. John was 17. And in an instance of resistance and repression, August 8, 1978, after a 15-month armed police standoff with the Philadelphia-based Naturalist MOVE organization, the police raided MOVE, killing one of their own in police crossfire and charging nine MOVE people with murder. The MOVE Nine and prisons across Pennsylvania are serving up to 100 years each. August, a month of injustice and divine justice, of repression and righteous rebellion, of individual and collective efforts to free the slaves and break the chains that bind us. August saw slaves and the grandsons of slaves strike out for their God-given right to freedom, as well as the awesome price, the ultimate price, always paid by those who would dare oppose the slave master's will. Like their spiritual grandfather, the blessed rebel Nat Turner, those who oppose Massa in this land of unfreedom met murder by the state. George and Jonathan Jackson, James McLean, William Christmas, Bobby Hutton, Steve Bartholomew, Robert Lawrence, Tommy Lewis, Sylvester Bell, all suffered the fate of Nat Turner, of the slave daring to fight the slave master for his freedom. Rochelle McGee, for the crime of surviving the Marin County Courthouse massacre, has been consigned to a life in California slave coffles, modern-day dungeons called adjustment centers, where he has languished since August 1970. He is a political prisoner guilty of the unpardonable sin of insurrection. And though not executed by hanging like his ancestor, Nat Turner, nor executed by firing squad like his co-rebels, he endures a cruel living death in the bowels of Babylon. Their sacrifice, their despair, their determination, and their blood has painted the month black for all time. Let their revolutionary sacrifice not be forgotten nor taken in vain. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Last week in part one, I talked to Ashanti about his experiences as a black revolutionary and about COINTELPRO. Then we moved to what is up with some of the people still imprisoned and those released. As you know, COINTELPRO, the counterintelligence program, was a government attack on the Black Panther Party and the American Indian Movement, as well as anti-Vietnam War groups and others. Also, we spoke of Mumia Abu-Jamal, journalist on Death Row, Assata Shakur in exile in Cuba, Native American Leonard Peltier rotting in federal prison for over 25 years after a frame-up by the U.S. government. We spoke of the Black Liberation Army soldiers that fought for what they believed in and are no longer with us. Then there's the amazing release of Geronimo Gijaga Pratt and Daruba Bin Wahad, two former Black Panthers. Amazing, not because the government was just, but just because they let them out. Here's Geronimo now, speaking from last week's town hall meeting for Mumia Abu-Jamal in New York.
For years, people said, well, Geronimo, he got life. They slandered my name through COINTELPRO. I was just in that. I would never get out of prison. And then the guards got stabbed, and then I was put on death row, and then somebody else got killed. Geronimo is never getting out of prison. But I'm here. And I'm here because of you. See? And I want you to continue to render that kind of support that you gave for me and so many others for Mumia, because even though the crime bill exists and it doesn't look too bright through those channels of domestic law, the power of the people is stronger than the pig's technology. We can win. We can free Mumia just like I was freed. Before I leave, I want to take a minute for you to reflect on a death row cell and a death row situation, not to try to draw on your sympathies, but try to encourage your strengths and to remember this old dictum that in a society that imprisons unjustly, the only place we talk about rationale for a just person is in prison. So let's go to prison. And let's tear them down from inside. We're already in minimum security. Let's stand up. If you're talking about civil disobedience, do that. If you're talking about picking up the gun, do that. Armed struggle, do that. Just get it together. Let's do something. Let's stop them from killing Mumia. Stop them from killing people all throughout the communities. And let's get it on. Thank you for everything. Let's free Mumia. I wish I had more time to talk to you. Power to the people. Mandela.
Today we're going to continue with Ashanti's book suggestions for your own education on the topic, and then move on to some current events and a very interesting and insightful discussion. Here's Ashanti and his books. I know you love books, so maybe you could tell the people what a few books, if they wanted to read about these stories and get a better idea, what would your favorite three books be for the movement?
Well, now that's not as simple as you think. If it's historical facts that people want, I would suggest they do what I do. I'm in the library a lot. I go to, like in New York here, New York has a certain advantage maybe over a lot of other places because of our access to libraries. The Tamiment Library, the New York University, specializes in movement history that goes back to the 1800s, whether you're dealing with the socialists, the nationalists, the feminists, the different ethnic group movements. You can find, if not actual documents, newspapers, pamphlets, position papers there. If they don't have the actual paper, they got it on microfilm. If you want to know about the anarchist movements, you can go there. And they have this stuff there. People are more than willing to help you. So you'll find a lot of stuff. There's so much. I don't even know if I can name three books, even on the Panthers. But if I did have to name three books on the Panthers, or three or more, you're talking about, of course, Bobby Seale's Seize the Time. You're talking about Asada's book, her autobiography. I would not even discourage people from reading David Hilliard's book or Elaine Brown's, but I do have some biases. Elaine Brown's is Taste of Power. David Hilliard's book is This Side of Glory. And the reason I have biases towards them, because having been a Panther at the time of the split, I have read their version of it. And I have read their version of the East Coast, which is what I was a part of, the East Coast. And what I read is like, nah, that wasn't us. And because it paints us in such a bad light that they make us out to be crazy people. People that were just wild and no discipline. And Elaine's book does a lot to make her look like a princess, but she's not honest in owning up to her own responsibilities and a lot of things that happened that caused the party to fall. Right now, there's the beginning of theoretical work being done on the Panther Party, more theoretical analysis. Like the major book out right now that came out last year is Black Panther Party Reconsidered. It is a major theoretical work, and I was very happy to see it. Doesn't necessarily mean I agree with every essay in the book, but it is so important for people to begin to analyze the history, the importance of the Black Panther Party from different angles, different perspectives. So it's good. From a feminist perspective, from people who do strictly Marxist-Leninist perspective, there's people who even do postmodernist analysis of the Black Panther Party. And you will find in all of them some aspects highlighted that you can say, that's an important point. I think that's something I can learn from. So I was very happy that that book came out. And then there's the source when you go to Panthers themselves, you know, so that you can hear Panther stories. Every Panther will give a different story because each Panther is different. East Panther's story will be based off of their personal experiences, what they understood, what after years, after the demise of the party, what they've learned, how that goes into helping them to understand what happened. And each one's story is as valid and as valuable as someone else's. I think that Panther women must still tell their story. And I think that their story, we will find, will be one of tremendous value, because they will have a story that will give more of the essence of the Black Panther Party in terms of what it was like for us as people within the Black Panther Party. Not those who just took on a new ideology, but as people who came from an oppressed community, who took on a mission, but we still carried the baggage of that oppression and how we had to struggle through that. So that, yes, the men of the Black Panther Party were definitely the leaders. And yes, the men were definitely sexist, but there were struggles going on within the Panther Party, encouraged by the Panther leadership to deal with things like sexism. There were struggles encouraged by the leadership to deal with things like democracy and the lack of democracy, because we had models of people like Mao and others who said that internal democracy is good. So when people took that to heart and really believed it, people really tried to practice that. Other people are telling the story of the Black Panther Party, especially of the Panther women right now. And rarely do you see them using Panther women as their resources. So they're giving the impression that there was this great sexism within the Panther Party and the women just, you know, were submissive and just took all this. They were abused, they were raped, they was harassed, they was even killed or whatever. And the thing of it is not to say that any of that didn't happen, but then you're not telling the full story. You're not telling the story of Panther women who fought to make changes in the Black Panther Party, who fought to maintain their respect and to maintain the standards that they felt revolutionaries should have for each other, especially in terms of women breaking out of past roles. And it was up to everybody to break out of past roles, because that was the whole thing. Whatever man meant to you before, now you're talking about Panther Man. Whatever woman meant before, you're talking about Panther Woman. So we made gallant efforts to really break out of those things, but it's not necessarily saying that we were 100%.
Just to put my two cents in on a couple of books that I would suggest. First of all, you're right, Assata Shakur, an autobiography. And another book, which is really scary, is The Agents of Repression by Ward Churchill and Jim Vanderwall. And that was the FBI Secret Wars Against the Black Panther Party and the American Indian Movement, complete with lots of documentation and pictures. Also, Live from Death Row by Mumi Abu-Jamal. It's a compilation of essays that he wrote while in prison.
The muted public response to the mass murder of MOVE members has set the stage for acceptable state violence against radicals, against blacks, and against all those deemed socially unacceptable. In the 60s and 70s, the Black Panther Party defined a relationship between the police and the black community as one between an occupying army and a colony. The confrontations between MOVE and this system's armed domestic forces has given that claim credence. In an article in the Village Voice in 1991, quoting an anonymous white cop giving his prescription for bringing law and order to Los Angeles, consider the following. Cop 1. You want to fix this city? I say you start out with carpet bombing. Level some buildings. Plow all this shit under and start all over again. Cop 2. Christ, you drop a bomb on a community? Cop 3. Oh yeah, there'd be some innocent people, but not that many. There's just some areas of L.A. that can't be saved. The twisted mentalities at work here are akin to those of Nazi Germany, or perhaps more appropriately, of My Lai, of Vietnam, of Baghdad. The spirit behind the mindlessly murderous mantra that echoed out of Da Nang, we had to destroy the village in order to save it. As abroad, so here at home, for as the flame smothered life on Osage Avenue, police and politicians spoke of destroying the neighborhood surrounding the MOVE house in order to save it. Now, Cops patrol neighborhoods across America armed like stormtroopers, with a barely disguised urge to destroy the very area they are sworn to serve and protect, or perhaps we should say sever and dissect. As they sit and sup and smoke, what animates their minds? Are they an aid to the people or a foreign army of occupation? May 13th, 1985 should have answered that question decisively. MOVE founder John Africa wrote over a decade ago, "It is past time for all poor people to release themselves from the deceptive strangulation of society. Realize that society has failed you. For to attempt to ignore the system of deception now is to deny you the need to protest this failure later. This system has failed you yesterday, failed you today, and has created the conditions for failure tomorrow. For society is wrong. The system is reeling. The courts of this complex are filled with imbalance. Cops are insane. The judges enslaving. The lawyers are just as the judges they confront. They are Harvard and Princeton and Cornell and Yale, and trained as the judge to deceive the impoverished, trained as the judge to protect the established, trained by the system to be as the system, to do for the system, exploit with the system, and MOVE ain't going to close our eyes to this monster." Unquote, from John Africa's judge's letter. It was true then. It's even truer now. This system has failed all of us. Indeed, it is the problem. Organize this very day to resist it, to oppose it, to go beyond it. Demand that all imprisoned MOVE members be released and all political prisoners be freed. That is a beginning. That is a first step we can all take today. On the MOVE, long live John Africa. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
As many people know, last week here in New York, we had the killing, the assassination of an African man by four police, special unit pigs in the Bronx, that shot a man, 41 bullets, shot him, hit him 19 times. The man was unarmed. He was in his own home. And in New York, we have the 48-hour rule where the police don't have to talk for 48 hours. So, and then they had the weekend besides. So you're talking about 4 days of time to plan their stories and the ridiculous kind of excuse that they want to have about how they could have shot somebody 41 times. Anyway, through that, there seems to be talk about what to do about it. And on a progressive talk show, there was talk of shooting cops might be called for at this point. The guy was taking calls, and this prompted my co-producer Frank to think up this question to ask you. If a cop were shot today, the Diallo case would vanish tomorrow. Giuliani and Safer are praying that a cop will be killed as soon as possible. This sort of thinking plays right into the government's hands. One civil rights worker in the South once said that the movement had succeeded to the point where the cops' guns were tied to their legs. They couldn't use them. And then the Panthers appeared, and all of a sudden the cops were able to start using their guns again. So the larger question is, does violence and macho posturing work? What does it accomplish besides enabling the cops to do the same thing 10 times over? And is it just an excuse to avoid the difficult work of organizing?
And this is from your co-producer, Frank. Let me say this. Number one, it's not even really important that 41 shots was fired and killed this brother. It's that this same occupation army does the same thing. And it does the same thing for the same reason. Anytime they kill some black person or person of color in the black community, communities, because there are many communities within the black community, but they're all oppressed communities. And this occupation army, which we call the New York City Police Department, has a job, and that is to maintain order in the community. And one of the ways they maintain order is through terror. Now, terror is not something that Giuliani and them use often, but they understand, like any occupation army, you got to use it every now and then because you need to keep people terrorized. The media does the main work. The messages that people get from home, school, church, any institution does the main work of keeping people under control. But every now and then it's good to just go out there and kill that person. You got to let people know that you are here to maintain order. So here they have this brother. And so these four pigs decide, we're going to kill him. Okay, he resembles some rapist, serial rapist. Their actions indicate people who have total disregard for human life, period. In the Black Panther Party, we called them pigs, and it was the reason we called them pigs. They were foul-natured beasts who had no respect for law and order, which is what they say they stand for, or most importantly, for human life. When they act like that, people should call them what they are. A lot of times, language becomes very important. When we say police, police is the officially correct word for them. So when we buy into the language, we also perpetuate the myths that they are there to do a job, and that's what this that legitimizes them. When some people say things like macho posturing is violence, they throw the violence question. I mean, it throws us and our reactions and responses to oppression in that light of, well, it delegitimizes our righteous anger towards our oppression. What Frantz Fanon would say is, you should do whatever you got to do to get rid of your oppressor. And in, even in attacking your oppressor, you actually free yourself from what you have internalized, the fears you've internalized of your oppressor that keeps you under control. If someone, as the Black Panther Party did in initiating the Black Liberation Army, goes on the warpath against the frontline troops, which is the New York City Police Department or any police departments that's there to maintain control in these communities, then it's a righteous thing. You must show people that this enemy is not infallible, that this enemy can fall, that they are still basically human beings, and that whatever you need to do to remove that enemy, you're justified in doing. You have people who did like Nat Turner did, and because they made other people may not agree with what they did, these people were angry at oppression. They're angry at what's been going on, and at some point decided they're going to take action. It doesn't matter to me whether it was well planned or not. These people are tired of being oppressed, and somebody caught it. All right. But what the police department do and what the media do, it keeps putting us in such a light that it makes any actions that we take against our oppressors illegitimate. When the Black Liberation Army did respond to a lot of these shootings that these pigs was doing in the community of our children and others, I think that statistics will show that the rate of these pigs shooting us went down, that they were so nervous that they didn't know when they was going to be ambushed or what was going to happen when they turned the corner or lit that cigarette in their car while they taking a little, break, that they thought twice about shooting our people down. And I think that was one of the reasons why the government and Nixon, and you'll see it in some of the reports, made it clear, you got to get rid of them. Get them, do whatever you got to do. Get them Black Liberation Army people off the streets. Too dangerous an example to set. So when the thing happens with this brother in the Bronx, I mean, for me, it's like, it is going to reach a time where others will, from example, from experience, from trial and error, they will begin to reach the conclusion that we must begin to fight back. We must begin to exact a political consequence when they come and shoot us. And sometimes that political consequence is going to express itself in terms of guerrilla warfare. And, it's like Malcolm said, you will see a terrorism that will terrify you. And he's saying that because he's taking into context what's been going on in this country from day one, that you can't keep a people pent up. You can't keep just shooting people down. You can't just keep throwing people out of work into shelters or into abandoned buildings and dogging them and don't expect a response. What we hope that as people that's been in the movement for a long time is that we can begin to see the need to unify and develop some kind of strategies where we can move towards getting rid of, destroying, demolishing this whole inhuman system, and at the same time begin to replace it with something very humanistic, something very loving, something very communal, that we can get rid of the conditions that create this madness. And right now, that's what's madness, but the madness is located not in the black communities, it's located in the institutions that maintain law and order, that maintain the madness.
I'm sort of the reactionary, angry person. I know that some people, maybe Frank here, is going to be the one that's going to try to stay calm and organize 100,000 people to come out in the streets or something like that. And that would be excellent. But I think there has to be room for both of those kinds of people, and both of those kinds of struggles need to happen.